Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and I wanted to go over the press conference today at the Combine with John Harbaugh and Eric DaCosta, go over some of the comments that were made and how I read between some of the things that they're saying, how I interpret some of the things that they're saying. So let's go through that. There's a lot of coach speak in here. There's some GM speak as well in terms of things that don't necessarily mean anything in terms of praising players or individuals. I'll perhaps hit on that, but I'm going to spend a lot less time on it. Obviously, the primary topic for both parties was the Justin Tucker situation. And in total, EDC faced six questions on Justin Tucker and Harbaugh faced another seven. So that was 13 questions out of what were probably about 35 questions, I would say, in total asked. So it was the primary focus of this discussion. Eric started off with some comments about job security, though, with the franchise that has had just two general managers and three head coaches in its 29-year history. Talked about success, belief in the systems, reliance on the successful team history in order to go forward with additional decisions of a similar type. So they're not doomed to make the same mistakes as history. They're looking to learn from the history of the team. And the belief from ownership, he pointed to as Steve Bisciotti being extremely supportive in terms of his people not being interfering. And that is some of that is interpretation on my part. But Steve Bisciotti, he directly, was very enthusiastic about. With regard to Tucker, there's a lot of things that went into this. So I'm just going to go through some of the things for both guys, and then we're going to leave on this, get back to the football stuff. So both the allegations, this is from DaCosta, both the allegations and the amount of allegations are serious and concerning. Okay, nobody's disagreeing with that. I think we all know, and he wanted to put it out there. He thanked the first person who asked a question about that. I'm happy to get that question. By the end of this day, I don't think they were happy to get all of the additional questions about it. They appreciate having the league investigate. So the NFL is apparently in Baltimore talking to massage therapists who have had allegations against Tucker. And there's definitely a heavy preponderance of understanding that the Ravens will rely on the NFL's decision in terms of what that punishment or what the behavior was, how serious the allegations are, all of that in terms of how they react to the Tucker situation. I think it's probably the most appropriate thing. The worst thing the Ravens can do is make their own decision about Justin Tucker and then have the league come in and say something different about it. And in some ways, that's what happened with Ray Rice. The league initially decided it was just a two-game suspension. Then they came back and they said, oh, no, we were wrong. He's going to have to be out for much longer than that. So that's the sort of thing that you really don't want to get whipsawed in terms of your judgment then being overridden by that of the league, or you having even to fall into the league's position. So they're doing a good thing to let the league investigate this thing. They said they'd wait patiently for the information, make decisions based on that. And talking about moving forward with additional kickers, they underscored Randy Brown's central role, and this was EDC, in evaluating punters, kickers, and long snappers. By the way, if you want to change the whole Wolfpack at once, this might be the time. Jordan Stout has 1 year left on his contract. Nick Moore, I think, is in a similar situation. So you're in a position where if you're changing kickers, you might also decide you're going to change the bulk of your unit. Nick Moore is a little bit older than you would expect, given on his years of service. I think he's about 30 now. And Jordan Stout, there are questions about whether or not he's been good enough as a punter. I think he's probably been good enough to get this fourth year. But on the other hand, if you're bringing in a new kicker and you want to get him used to a new punter as the holder from the very first moment, you might still make that change. And there's another podcast out there on Jordan Stout and his future that I would point you to. EDC said he would not elaborate on the zero tolerance policy and underscored the need to look at each case individually. Harbaugh was similar asked about what it meant to have a zero tolerance policy with regard to Tucker. And he said each case is individual as well. I think there's a mistake, and I wish the one of Harbaugh or EDC would have addressed this directly. Zero tolerance does not mean there is no due process for looking into these things. It does not mean that. And you wouldn't want to have that. You wouldn't want to have summary judgments made on the street with regard to rape that would be, or murder for that matter, that would just have a police officer immediately putting the head, the gun to the head of a accused murderer and making the decision there. This is not what you want. I mean, there needs to be a due process for this. And yes, the Ravens may benefit from that due process, taking a little bit more time and getting a post June 1 cut out of it, for example, without having to use one of their two that they get for free each year. So there are little things like that. I think they will wait at least till the beginning of the league year to cut Tucker. But there were other indications that Tucker is not going to be around. And in particular, John Harbaugh mentioned that Tucker had been a great kicker, but nothing lasts forever. And I'm paraphrasing slightly there. See if I can bring the exact thing up. But anyway, there's a past tense to it that is a little bit concerning with regard to Tucker. So they have to look at every position, he mentioned, and I'll just read the quote directly. We're looking at every position, but I'd say kicker position would have been a priority no matter what. Because Justin Tucker is our kicker, we love him, and I always would have expected him to keep going forever, but nobody goes forever. So we have to look at every position like we do. So rather than misquote the thing or misinterpret the thing, there's the quote, interpret it as you will. I think they're probably trying to figure out what their next move is at kicker at this point, and they understand that it's unlikely that Tucker will see action in 2025. All right, let's see, what else was there? Anything else? Both EDC and EDC mentioned he talked with Tucker personally and will keep those discussions privately. And also John Harbaugh had talked with him, and he said the focus of his discussion with Tucker was in how he was treating this with his family. So he's not getting into the fault or guilt or whatever you want to call it. He's getting into the how does he fix his life with his family kind of thing. So I think the Ravens are taking what I would say is the correct stance with this. They want to wait and see, and they want the NFL to be the first to say, yes, we find these allegations very serious and worthy of a full year suspension or whatever it might be for Justin Tucker before they decide what to do with Justin Tucker. I think it's appropriate. I think it puts the team in the best possible position not to be overridden by the league in a way that will look very bad. So we'll see how this goes forward from here. But that's all I want to say about Tucker in this show. Back to EDC's comments. He said it was a good year for both the draft and UFA in terms of wide receivers. Receivers are available in every round at every price point in free agency. He mentioned good tight ends. That's something that I think a lot of Ravens fans are looking at. They had 143.5 passer rating the last 2 years combined, throwing to the tight ends. So certainly, if you look at them as receiving threats, then you need less in terms of wide receivers. There was no specific mention of the UFA wide receivers on the Ravens. Neither Tylan Wallace nor Aguilar was mentioned specifically, nor was Bateman or Flowers, for that matter. But they certainly had good years, and I think the questions were really about how do you expect to find new wide receivers. Okay, best news of the day probably is Ronnie Stanley on the prospect of an extension. I'm just going to read the quote directly from EDC. You never want to say 100%, but I feel good that we'll have a good, healthy debate, a good process. We'll meet with him, Kim in Indianapolis this week. I'm optimistic that we'll be able to get a deal done. Okay, Harbaugh echoed the desire to get Stanley back and the likelihood that might happen, but not as strongly as EDC did. And frankly, EDC is the one who ought to be commenting on this. So he's the one with negotiations and the knowledge of what the Ravens are willing to spend in terms of the cap. So that was good. Then he was asked immediately about the confidence of moving Rosengarten from right tackle to left tackle. He said he had a great year and was more mature than the typical young player. And we did see, by the way, that Rosengarten, even drafted where he was, had a much better rookie year than Mims and Guyton and some of the other guys who were drafted ahead of him. Suamataia, who was drafted, immediately after him, I believe. So it was he had a very good year relative to his draft position. The only guy who really had a better year at offensive tackle as a rookie this year was Joe Alt. He was the number 5 overall pick. So I think the Ravens are very happy with what happened to him. You know my feeling about it, if you listen to the show regularly, is that he was not really tested as much as he could have been. I'm still very happy with the level of aggregate production from him, but we haven't really seen the success in one-on-one island pass rush situations that we've had with Ronnie Stanley over the years, say, or other offensive tackles that the Ravens have had. They just did an incredible amount of set and chip blocking towards that size, using eligible receivers to plug the potential for weakness on that right side in terms of pass rush, opposing pass rush. They asked if he could be a factor moving to left tackle. EDC said he's a factor on the left side if need be. Okay, so obviously he wants to refer them back to the likelihood that they'll sign Ronnie Stanley, doesn't want to really get into it, but if need be was the way he put it. For what it's worth, John Harbaugh said that regarding Rosengarten at left tackle, I'll just give you this as a direct quote. Absolutely, yes. That would be one of the options we could go to. It would depend on the draft and different things like that and free agency. I think we'll probably keep Ronnie Stanley. I'm hopeful that we will, but if we don't, we'll have an option, and that would be one of them for sure, meaning moving Rosengarten to left tackle. I don't think they have a lot of options, frankly, if they don't. But the draft, he mentioned the draft. They could pick up a left tackle in the draft, and some of the mocks you'll see will have the Ravens getting a left tackle. One of the really big benefits of re-signing Ronnie Stanley is a big draft capital dividend you get in terms of not having to use the number one pick on a left tackle. So, because that almost certainly would demand it if Stanley walks out the door. So I think the Ravens still have a big decision to try and big issue to get resolved there at left tackle. And if they do it, there'll be a benefit to it beyond just the relative salary to other left tackles in the league. He was asked a question about building a team through the middle. He gave a sort of a vague answer, prioritized with the draft of Hamilton, Roquan, Travis Jones, Nnamdi Nwabike, Tyler Linderbaum, Lamar Jackson. Could have added Derrick Henry to that. He's certainly a guy in the middle. Anybody who is an analyst of the game will tell you it's real important on the outside too, to have great cornerbacks and great edge players, and players who affect the passing game typically are on the outside and not on the inside, although safety would be the big exception to that, and quarterback, of course. I think it was basically a throwaway comment, honestly, in terms of the building through the middle. The question, maybe better served there would have been, how do you relativize positional value? But if you ask that question, it's not a question he's going to answer directly, because he's going to insult a group of players or make unhappy a group of players who might otherwise want to play in Baltimore. So he's going to say it's case by case basis, blah, 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 blah. But the truth of the matter is, he was asked specifically, by the way, about running backs in that particular case. He says a difficult situation. If you have a Hall of Fame running back, or if you have an elite running back, they're really worth it. But analytics has de-emphasized the position in recent years. And so he's basically straddling the fence there in terms of the value of running backs. And you just will never get a GM to answer a question like that. And I think it's also the kind of question where you're not going to get any sort of meaningful information from him. But the one thing that DaCosta said from this is that he likes the draft for the defensive line, outside linebacker, and guard positions. So that's good. At least he gives you a little bit about what's going on. But the comment basically, as a quote, and I'm not going to read it to you, essentially says that the team wants to be good at everything. They want to stop the run. They want to be able to run the ball effectively. They want to stop the pass. They want to be, it's of course you want to be good at everything. The question is, what marginal things can you accept in order to be better at something else? And I'd rather, if I were asking a question here, I'd rather pin him down with something like the 2023 Ravens, made what appears to be a conscious effort to be a less aggressive run defense team in the name of more turnovers and better pass defense under the Mike McDonald scheme. with Zach, or we went back to more of a run defense first defense that had a lot of trouble dotting the I's and crossing the T's in the first 10 weeks of the season in terms of getting beat deep and being out of position deep. How do you reconcile the need for good run and pass defense and at least direct him or try and do? He will still find a way to evade that question, by the way. But you try and at least get him down to, hey, here's what I'm talking about. Which do you favor as an organization? And if you look at Ravens history, they have favored run defense over pass defense in their entire history. They basically, you know, for many years, they've never had a season where they'd allowed even 4 yards per carry rushing. And that remarkable streak of, I think, 21 years from 2000, so from 1996 through 2016, I believe 2017 was the first year they allowed 4 yards per carry. And in one case, in 2012, actually, when they won the Super Bowl, it was a kneel down on the final play of the season, which brought the opponent rushing just below 4 yards per carry. So it was actually pretty funny that they got to that point. But anyway, very hard to pin down a GM on that specific thing. So I don't fault whoever asked that question. I talked about Derrick Henry a little bit, praised his work ethic, his offseason training, leadership, how he takes care of his body, very important, and expects his success to continue in 2025. Of course, it's kind of like asking a doctor, was the operation successful? Yeah, absolute complete success. You know, there's no lawsuit to be had here. You know, and if he's, what's he going to say? That no, we really expect a certain amount of decline from Derek as he gets older. He ran the ball 320 times this year. My over under this year would be 260, and my over under in yardage would only be 1200. But yeah, we expect him to have some success this year. He's not going to give you a comment like that, even though that's probably somewhere where the truth lies. Is you know, a more reasonable over under, not as good a season in terms of what's happened. I'll give you that in the expectation series in terms of my perspective on it. People want to hear DaCosta's version of that, but they're never going to get it. Now, the interesting thing is he did say he's having a picture of Henry posted up as an office as an indication that an extension with Derrick Henry may be in the works. So he specifically said, what does that tell you that he's having this picture of Derrick Henry put up in his office? I'm not sure it tells me anything, but you know, because if you've ever been around, the castle has just all this wonderful Ravens history in it of, you know, every win has like kind of a picture from it. Every playoff win has like a painting of it. And, you know, there's all this wonderful artwork in the building of, you know, memorializing Ravens history. It wouldn't surprise me at all, you know, that you know, Eric DaCosta wanted Derrick Henry on his wall as, here's one of my triumphs as a general manager. I signed this guy who came in, had 1,900 yards, and a whole lot of people in the media said they were lukewarm on the idea, and that would include me, honestly. So I think it doesn't necessarily tell you Eric DaCosta is going to re-sign Henry, but it was a nice positive moment, I think, for the group there. Talked about Lamar Jackson. There were several things involved with the comments about Lamar. I'm going to take a drink here because sometimes, you know, you just don't get that chance when you don't have a guest on to do this. This is a problem I have with solo shows as I wind myself. Anyway, Lamar Jackson, regarding the impact on personnel decisions, this is a good one because remember, Lamar seemed to have an impact on the Odell Beckham signing, and one that probably is not the sort of thing that you want your quarterback involved in, or at least I would make it that way. He said he's a stakeholder, a partner, and he's earned the right to have input on this. He said he gets texts from him and says he will probably visit with him in Florida. I presume that means about the direction of the team, and maybe it's about his own off-season workout and whatnot, but presumably direction of the team. He was also asked if it is a general trend to have QBs more involved in personnel decisions. And he says, as far as he sees it, it's specific to Lamar, who should be a 3-time MVP and has earned a different status. Okay. I think it's a good answer. It's a specific case answer. It's the not getting pinned down answer. If he had just said, I think any team with a 3-time MVP that doesn't take their quarterback seriously in terms of who he wants to have at receiver or other offensive compliments is being foolish. I think that would have been a fine way to answer the question too, but it would have also meant it's specific to Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson then, because there's no other quarterback in the NFL currently that I think meets that standard. Nobody else has won 3 Super Bowls. All right. 3 MVPs. Talked about the draft and the balance of need and value. The question was not asked that way exactly, but he said that need sounds great when you draft a guy and you pencil him in to start, but if it doesn't work out, you look at it as a bad pick. And you don't really remember, and this is implied, I'm inferring this between the lines, you don't really remember what your needs were 5 years ago when you drafted a player. You judge that pick based on the production of that player overall. And so that's a good point. He gave the 2022 running back example where the Ravens had all the running backs go down literally in training camp with I think I've got the year right, with Dobbins, Gus Edwards, and Justice Hill all injured. And he was, talked about on a Friday afternoon being around, calling around the league to find, who could they bring in. And that's the year they had Devonta Freeman and Latavius Murray and some other guys come in, some older Le'Veon Bell, some older geriatric back brigade that they brought in. He didn't say that, by the way. Those are my words. He very much finished the question by emphasizing his own preference for talent and upside over need. I think that's been very clear in Ravens history. The draft picks that I personally get excited about are the ones that go against need. So you draft Kyle Hamilton, you say, what, why would we do that? We've got a perfectly good safety already. And the answer is when we have much more pressing needs. Otherwise, the answer is because you can't ignore the value of Kyle Hamilton at pick 14. And they didn't, and they got a great player. Particularly when you have a first-round player where you completely build around that guy and he's a huge percentage of your total draft capital, you can't afford to have that guy be a need pick who might not work out or might address the position but just be 60% of the player that some other guy is. You just can't afford to have that happen, no matter what, window you think you're in. You need to continually be looking for the cornerstone players who are going to be there for, oftentimes 8 years, two contracts worth and have Ring of Honor potential. Those are the guys you need to get in the first round. I do think you're fine going for need picks as you go later in the draft. And I think that's been the DaCosta method in general, is that they don't draft five offensive linemen if they only can fit three on the roster, even if they thought the five offensive linemen were the five best players or the best players at the time. So they have need, mixed into what they do, but obviously they have a high preference for value. He's asked about free agency this year. He said, the Ravens would continue their process of right player, right price. One of the funny things, he's talking about Nick Mateo, who has control of the Ravens cap now with Moriarty retired. And he said that they are looking for cap in the couch cushions. I love the term. You look for change in the couch cushions when you have to pay the paperboy or something like that. This is a case where, they're looking for 50 grand here, 75 grand here. One thing we've seen from the Ravens in recent years is that they will really look for small amounts and look to harvest those when they have an opportunity even to keep the 53-man roster at 52 or even 51 for a week, because they don't need to elevate anybody, or they don't need to sign another person to 53, or maybe they can elevate somebody and fill out the game day roster. It's just really smart cap management. It's not foolish. If nobody's knocking on the door, none of your practice squad guys are having the phone ring in order to poach them, then there's oftentimes you want to take advantage of those elevations. The Ravens have been remarkably effective at using not only the 53-man roster, but the extensions of the roster that are effectively allowed by the league rules in terms of how you put a player on IR after the roster is determined. There's now two spots where you can do this for free, but even before then, they could put additional players on by having handshake agreements with players like Anthony Levine and Brett Urban in the past, who would be signed at the minimum level and they'd be back and allow the team to extend the roster. So Ravens have done well on that, and that's cap in the couch cushions, and roster spots also in the couch cushions. They said they would, in free agency, would go after vet minimum players they like, and they've done a lot of that, and they thought successfully. He thought successfully, so that good point there. At no point did he indicate the Ravens would make a big splash in free agency from another team. And he discussed signing his own players and specifically the fact that Jackson, Humphrey, Matabike, and Roquan Smith, there's a big name excluded there, are taking up a large portion of the cap. And he specifically mentioned Hamilton as Linderbaum, as cornerstone players that they would have to sign. And this is the, didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Problem that all great drafting teams face is they have to make heartbreaking decisions about their own players. So a player like Brandon Stevens is walking. I know there's a lot of fans right now who don't consider that a heartbreaking decision, but he's been a Raven and he's played effectively enough over his period that the Ravens probably got their value out of that draft pick. If you're looking at other players like Pernell McPhee back in the day when he had to leave, I mean, there was just no option to keep him. There weren't enough dollars. Matthew Judon, same thing. Heartbreaking decisions had to be made about losing those players. Good comments there. Then we got to Mark Andrews. And of course, he's the missing name from the discussion of these cornerstone players who are eating a lot of the cap. I'm going to read the quote directly, and then I'll give my interpretations of it. Mark Andrews is a great player. We're blessed to have three really good tight ends under contract this year. They all contribute in different ways. Their chemistry, their camaraderie, their impact on the offense, their relationship with the other skill guys is great. I mean, Mark is going to go down as one of our great players. He'll be in the Ravens Ring of Honor someday. I love having Mark on the team. He's an amazing player. I know he's going to have an amazing season. We'll figure out all the roster machinations over the coming weeks, but I can tell you there's no bigger fan of Mark Andrews than me. He's been a blessing to have on this team. The first use of past tense there, by the way. His leadership, the way he approaches the game, his attention to detail, he's just one of those guys. So my translation of that is not that Mark Andrews is necessarily gone, but that all avenues are open on Mark Andrews at this point. He had one past tense mention where he's been a blessing to have on the team. I kind of wish, you know, he is a blessing to have on the team is probably the way you ought to say that. But it was said in the past tense, and it does probably give some indication of you know, the possibility that the Ravens will be moving on from Andrews. Right now, there are four possibilities. He could be cut. I think that's very unlikely. He could be traded. And the Ravens would, because he has a value that is greater than his 2025 salary, I think there's a lot of teams who would love to have Mark Andrews at $11 million. And I think he has some trade value. And whether that means they get a fourth or a fifth round pick or even a third round pick for him, I think is really the question. And the Ravens will have to then make the decision of, is he worth more to us or do we need to move on from him? I do think they're in a position where only one of Isaiah Likely and Mark Andrews will be on the team in 2026. All three contracts come due after 2025, which is a problem. Having stacked contracts like that at one position and across the roster in general, when you're talking about high value players, is a problem. You need to try and decouple that. And remember the 2018 draft, they had to unravel that draft kind of a piece at a time so that all these players didn't come due at the same time. They wouldn't have gotten comp value from everyone because, you know, it's too many players to lose at once. So they traded some of them. They traded Hayden Hurst and got a second round pick back. They eventually traded Orlando Brown and they got effectively a mid second round pick value for him back as well. And they traded Kenny Young, of course, and they picked up Marcus Peters, which really helped the team. And you know, that's just a smart organization doing smart things to work through the talent they have and unraveling a group of contracts that all come due at the same time. So those are the comments from Eric DaCosta. I thought, you know, good. There's just not a lot to go on, but I'm excited about the Henry comment. Sorry, the Stanley comment. I'm moderately excited about the Henry comment. And, you know, with regard to Andrews, I think he's keeping all the options open. So that kind of summarizes that. Let's move on to John Harbaugh, though. As I mentioned, 7 questions about Justin Tucker. I'm not going to go on about those again. These guys had to be prepared. I think they were getting very tired of the questions about Tucker towards the end, in particular questions about what does zero tolerance mean, you know, this and that. I mean, you know, zero tolerance doesn't mean no due process. And that's probably what I would have preferred the Ravens to say in this case. But anyway, enough on Tucker. The next thing that Harbaugh was given, which was primary, was on the coaching changes. And he mentioned, you know, all of that there have been over the last 3 to 5 years, the number of coaches that they have lost over that period to other organizations. He talked about the opportunities for the coaches who departed, including Anthony Weaver and Mike McDonald, and, you know, how proud he was of those guys. You know, there's other guys he could have mentioned, but those two are excellent choices. So no problem there. He talked about the excitement over having Chuck Pagano, Donald D'Alessio, Tyler Santucci, and Matt Pease in his coaches. Didn't mention Levine, didn't mention the promotion of Willie Taggart. You kind of look for who they leave out, but honestly, I don't think there's a problem. He's identifying a couple of young guys that he's happy with, you know, one old guy who I think is coming in to play a different role on the coaching staff in terms of Chuck Pagano. We've got other Friday morning GMs that I discussed that on, so I don't think I want to go over that again here. But, you know, Chuck Pagano is here for a limited amount of time, and I think one of the things he can really do is try and help, you know, perhaps a Donald D'Alessio take over a defensive backs role. And they lost Chris Hewitt, the defensive backs coach who they parted on mutual agreed terms. And you know, that was, it probably means they didn't really want to extend him, which is a normal thing on which you leave under mutual terms. Mentioned that the Ravens analysts have a coaching title. So the Ravens give them coaching credit within their own kind of yearbook. I thought it was interesting. Also, Willie Taggart is considered now a coordinator as an assistant with an assistant head coach tag. So he's the running backs coach, but he's given a coordinator role. So that's really nice. And in terms of his own resume and how it looks within the organizational structure, he's like the fourth coordinator along with the offense, defense, and special teams. So nice spot for him. He also mentioned, besides the analysts, that they have the most female coaches in the league, and he was proud of that. So a good thing there as well. He takes pride in the coaches who have moved on to other positions. And that's how he should. I mean, you know, a lot of people complain about coaches leaving us. That's what we aspire to. Success breeds these coaches being hired other places. Kansas City Chiefs have lost a bunch of coaches as well, in a similar manner. And it's just, it is the way things go. And if you want to be successful, you're going to lose a lot of coaches in the process. You look back to the real successful Billick years in 2000, 2001, you know, obviously they couldn't keep Marvin Lewis when he didn't have a head coaching opportunity in Baltimore. So they were fortunate to keep him one additional year. Billick did the right things to make him a tape that he could take, a VHS tape, I think at the time, that he could take to other teams as part of an advocacy for him to be a head coach. He ended up in 2002, spending a year in Washington as a defensive coordinator before he finally got that head coaching role in 2003. So it just takes time sometimes, and sometimes you luck out and those coaches like Monken this year stay for an additional year, and maybe Monken is never really considered to be head coaching material because of his age, you know, in particular, not because he's not a good football mind. But it's sometimes you luck out and sometimes you don't, but you can't try and hold down your organization. If you've ever managed a group of people or a department of people, the worst thing you can do for morale and the success of your team is to try and hold your people down. You need to lift them up. You need to try and get them opportunities to, you know, spread the seed of a really high functioning department into other departments of the company, rather than hold down your good people. So anyway, that's something that I think is very important from any management perspective, and I really appreciate what Harbaugh has done with it. Okay, he had some funny comments about Jim Harbaugh, kind of throwaway comments that I don't think they're worth mentioning. He talked a little bit about looking forward to some defensive tackles and defensive ends in the draft, game-wrecking defensive tackles and pass-pressuring defensive ends. Mentioned that they, you know, they're looking to build for starters on both sides of the line. I think that's clearly where the Ravens need to consider it in terms of being an older defensive line unit at this point, with a couple of players in Urban and Pierce who appear close to the end. Pierce may or may not actually be retired at this point. He hasn't announced it yet that I've heard. I have heard that Urban is likely to try and come back for another year. If he makes it, great. And if he doesn't, I don't think his spot is guaranteed, but he's an option for the Ravens. But that said, I think they're going to draft defensive line players in a year where the defensive line is supposedly deep in the draft. And I think that they will attempt to get younger this year. Had some very lean years of defensive line talent in recent years, starting with the COVID year, where a lot of defensive linemen effectively took a year off. And I think we're just playing through to the end of that now, where some players might have been literally in their freshman year of college when COVID hit and decided to defer their start of college play, and others deferred their entry into the draft, or deferred, it took a gap year effectively from football during the COVID era. So we're just getting to the end of that, the impact of the pandemic on the defensive line in particular. Harbaugh had some comments about his role on the competition committee, and there were some interesting things here. He said that he's very active in that, and he thinks that other people on the competition committee would say, I quote, "Yes, he's been a little bit of a pain about that." Okay, so one thing apparently Harbaugh is advocating for is as much replay as makes sense to get it right as much as we can. And that, I think, is a direct quote, but it's close. If it's not, I point you to the interview if you want to hear exactly what he said. But clearly, I think he may be referring not only to the use of replay in determining the outcomes of play, the spot of the football, et cetera, but also potentially in determining penalties. And that's where I think the Ravens and Harbaugh feel like they got a really raw deal in 2024, in particular, particularly early in the season, and that he wants it done differently. The illegal formation crusade in that first week is just one of the most regrettable and stupid things that the NFL has tried to do recently. In terms of a point of emphasis that just did not work. And, you know, hitting the Ravens up three times on that first drive was probably one of the most egregious things of the whole year. I'm glad to see it from an officiating perspective. And I'm glad to see the Ravens scored anyway on that drive, because otherwise there'd have been hell to pay in terms of having three potentially drive stalling penalties for a flag that the Ravens actually dispute how they were told about it by the officials. So that should not happen, and the officials shouldn't have that kind of a footprint on the game. There should at least be warnings that go with that. Don't know if those occurred or not, but not happy with the way that was officiated. He was asked specifically about the tush push, and he said effectively that he was okay with the tush push, but that if you take the tush push out of the game, then you have to take out all downfield pushing and pulling of running backs and of receivers for that matter. And right now, that was not currently being officiated that way, even though it's in the rules. So, and he's right, by the way. We've seen Yanda in the 2012 Mile High Miracle game at Denver had a great push to achieve a big first down on the game-winning field goal drive in the second, that crossed over between the first and second overtime. You can't officiate it that way for years, and then all of a sudden mid-season say pick up and say, okay, we're going to do it differently now. We're going to do this. So the competition committee is going to have to put something in place. And then the league is going to have to enact that by vote of the owners. And then the officials are probably going to need to take it as a point of emphasis in order to really get it enacted properly. The analogous situation existed in baseball for many years is the blocking of home plate by the catcher. It was always allowed in play, in actual play, and never allowed in the rule book. It's always been illegal to block on plate. It's been specifically illegal to block on plate in the rule book for those many years. And now they finally got more specific points of emphasis to basically overrule 100 plus years of umpiring that did it a different way, that was not in line with the rule book. But the catcher was allowed, and he's properly geared up to block home plate and stop a player from getting his foot into home plate while he's accepting the throw. That's not allowed anymore. He has to give the runner a lane to get to home plate. And they are pretty draconian in ruling against the catcher in such ways like this. So it could be enacted in the NFL to deal with these situations with push plays. But Harbaugh, I think, is probably correct that you need to get rid of all push plays if you're going to get rid of any push plays. And I think that there will be teams like the Eagles are the current beneficiary of the tush push, but they won't be the only beneficiary forever. And I think the Ravens, you know, do it fairly well. So I would look it does bring up an extra need to have big offensive linemen on the field and to have other big personnel on the field to make it work properly. So the other point he made about the competition committee items, and I think this relates directly to it, although it wasn't clear from the question, was that Steve B is the boss in terms of the organization's position, but as a group, they go give input and they agree to agree, as opposed to agree to disagree. They agree to agree. So I guess this is oftentimes you'll hear this with the Supreme Court, that they really want a decision to be unanimous rather than give any kind of mixed message about what's going on, particularly on social issues. So the most famous one of all time, probably the familiar to a lot of people, is the Muhammad Ali decision. In terms of his own his avoidance of the draft and how the Supreme Court ruled on it, they talked internally and made sure they had a unanimous decision exonerating Ali in that case. And that was very important to them. So they did it that way. You don't want to have a 5-3 decision on such a thing. You want the court to act with one voice on social issues like that. There are other kings where you can't get that kind of unanimity, and maybe you can't with the current Supreme Court. We don't need to go into a political discussion over that. But when it's possible and it's a social issue, generally speaking, the court likes to act unanimously. When it's a different issue, maybe an economic issue or another issue involving other elements of the law, you will have dissenting opinions. And then it's just important that those dissenting opinions get aired when they're different from the majority. All right. He was asked about the Rosengarten moving to left tackle. He said, absolutely, yes, that would be one of the options we could go to. Again, direct quote here. It would depend on the draft and different things like that in free agency. I already said this before. We already talked about this in the previous discussion of Stanley. So talked about it being an option, and it's kind of an indication that's one of one options. If they don't re-sign Stanley, of course, they could draft somebody. Okay. Next player you talked about was Andrew Voorhees. Two questions about Voorhees. The first was, does he have a shot at left guard the coming year? He said, definitely. He's in there. And he praised him for his play in week 17 against Houston when he came in late in the year, is what he said. But it's week 17 against Houston when Patrick McCary had some sort of I think he probably had diarrhea. But he tried to go, played six plays, was pulled out of there. And then effectively Voorhees played the entire game. And he did play pretty well, as I scored it as well. So I like that. He mentioned that Patrick McCary had played great when he got hurt. It's interesting that there's no mention of Patrick McCary in this press conference, but there's also no question about Patrick McCary in terms of, are they going to try and re-sign him? I think the likelihood is very low that they do re-sign him. And I don't think there's anything in terms of the comments about Voorhees that would tell you McCary is likely to be re-signed. A lot of services put his value at almost $10 million a year. If he's worth $10 million a year, you got to sign Stanley and let McCary go. But it will put the Ravens in a pinch in terms of having that versatile sixth man off the bench who can play anywhere you need him to play. He's been very valuable to the Ravens over the year in that regard. He's just not worth $10 million a year. So, by the way, very happy with how McCary played. He did say McCary played great when Voorhees got hurt. I would agree that I thought McCary's play was at a high level. And in particular, once he cut his penalties after week 10, he was a terrific player, a B overall for the year at guard, as I scored it. He's asked about the importance of adding a pass rusher, completely deflected the question, which was interesting. I don't think the Ravens want to be pinned down on how they address their pass rush problem, with air quotes there, that they have. He says he discussed how they get home with scheme. He talked about stunts, blitzes, various types of blitzes, zone blitzes, man blitzes, all out blitzes. But he said, we want to keep people guessing. He said, we want to show simulated pressure. You want to rush with four when they didn't know who the four were. So there's a lot of things like that that he talked about, but didn't really address the need to get a first round or a high pedigree edge rusher. And so it'll be interesting to see how the Ravens move forward with that. It has been a position, obviously, where they had tremendous success in finding guys who were cheap veterans that gave them a lot of production. And, you know, just recently, Justin Houston, Jason Pierre-Paul, Kyle Van Noy, and Jadeveon Clowney all fit into that group. And they've got so much production, you really look at it as, what can our organization do well that we don't need to have the draft be our only avenue of success? Because that draft capital is precious. And despite the fact the Ravens have 11 picks, don't be fooled for a moment. They do not have a lot of draft capital at all. In fact, if they traded every single one of their 11 draft picks, they could probably get up to have either the 10th or 11th pick in the draft. So right there, that'd tell you there's 10 teams, with more draft capital than they have. And then there's a hell of a lot more than that, actually, when you incorporate their lower round picks of the teams who draft between, say, 11 and 20. So the Ravens are in a tough draft capital position, as they always are, and they'll make the best of their situation. But the notion that they should use all their picks to trade up, I think this is not necessarily a year where you do that. They have a lot of holes to fill. In some ways, they enter the draft in a good position, because having a lot of holes to fill means you're not pigeonholed into drafting one spot or the other. If they sign Ronnie Stanley in particular, their need to draft a tackle goes way down, so that helps them in terms of effective draft capital if that happens. So I think this is it'll be a good year for the Ravens to get more of those value picks as opposed to need picks. And the way you get the most value picks is to keep all your individual selections intact. So, there may be a case or two where they decide, hey, we want to move down and be able to move up. Sorry, we want to move up and draft this guy, and we want to move down because we think our value guy will still be there 6 picks from now. There may be some of that, and that's fine. But I think there's not a strong impetus to me to trade picks to make your 11 into 9 picks or into 7 picks that are really good ones, because you don't get that much additional value from trading those guys. The picks they have are mostly late in the draft. They don't even have a 5th round pick. I think they have 3 6s and 2 7s. So right there, that ought to tell you they don't have a whole lot of draft capital in this draft. So in addition to drafting 27th, you know, they draft 59th and 91st, I believe it is. So their picks in each of the first 3 rounds are low. And that's just the nature of the game when you have as much success as the Ravens have had. Anyway, outstanding press conference from the two of them. There was certainly some value that came out, and there's the usual avoidance of key topics and the inability for, I think, the media in general to get meaningful answers out of a coach and GM who have as much experience as Harbaugh and EDC at the podium and are good at sidestepping questions that will get them into trouble. So it's a good trait of your organization to have. I kind of wish that John Harbaugh had more in terms of injuries during the season. I wish he would just have absolute no comment philosophy with regard to any injuries. And he certainly imposes that on his other coaches who go to the podium, or his other players who are hurt, are not allowed to the podium. But if you ask an injury question of Todd Monken, he says, I'll have to defer any injury questions to the head coach or to John, but he's not going to give you anything. If you ask John, he may or may not tell you something. And the problem is he kind of wants to give you good news. And I wish he would just employ an our only comment is no comment rule with regard to injury. I think Belichick was much better in doing exactly that. And if I had to point to a change in comportment for Harbaugh, who I think generally does very well with the media, I think that would be the one thing I'd advocate for. All right. Thanks a lot for listening to this. For all you folks out there who'd like to be on a film study short, this is the perfect time of year. Okay. Hit me up. My DMs are always open. I want to hear from you. I've got a lot of great ideas for individual shorts. Some of them are roster building. We're in the middle of a long stretch of UFA advocacy shows. So if you have a particular unrestricted free agent from outside the organization you'd like the Ravens to go after, it could be a pipe dream. Like the very first guy wanted T. Higgins, and a lot of the early shows are going to be on some of the high value players. And it's probably very unlikely the Ravens will sign one of those. But if you have good reasoning as to why you want that, or a plan in particular cap-wise of how the Ravens would spread that out, or who they might have to get rid of in order to make it work, I'm interested in hearing from you. And in particular, if you have a lesser-known UFA you'd like to talk about, that's also a great place where I'd like to hear from you. Otherwise, thanks for all the listens, folks. It's been a great year, and we really appreciate all of the folks who are listening. As always, if you want to help out, a five-star 50-word review on your favorite podcast platform is a nice thing to do, or just tell that next person who you think might appreciate this sort of content. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.